essentially the guardianship of the person of Roseanne Lynn Brome, aka Bonaparte. First of all, just a few logistical items. As I mentioned, we're holding these arguments virtually, so we just want to check to make sure that we can hear both of the parties. So I'll start with respondent's attorney. If you can speak just so to make sure that we can actually hear you. We can see both parties, but we just want to check to see if we can hear you.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Okay, sounds good. Appellant's attorney?
Yes, good morning, Your Honor.
Okay, wonderful. We're using a slightly different WebEx technology today, so hopefully we won't have any issues. If we do, for whatever reason, we will, if, for instance, if we can't hear you or if you run into any technical difficulties, we can stop the clock and restart it once you connect. We have noticed that at times when people are working remotely, depending on their internet connection, that sometimes the video doesn't work as we can't hear you as well if the video is on as well. Both of you sounded clear, so it shouldn't be an issue, but just wanted to let you know that. Generally, we ask the other party that is not speaking to go on mute just to avoid any background noise that may arise. As we all know, working this way, that there can be unintended interruptions or noise in the background. So if you can do that, that'd be greatly appreciated. And I think that is about it. So with that, appellant's counsel, you may proceed.
Yes, thank you. Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. Today, the three issues I will be
And
raising
counsel,
are.
if you can just state your name for the record, this is being recorded as well.
I apologize, Your Honor. Good morning again, Attorney Jessica Buberl, Buberl, on behalf of the appellant, Roseanne Bonaparte. She officially had her name changed in March of 2020 in Anoka County and is now known by Roseanne Lynn Bonaparte. And I will be proceeding on her behalf this morning. The three issues that I will be raising are, one, was the evidence clear and convincing that appellant needs a guardian? Two, did the trial court abuse its discretion when it awarded the guardian all of the statutory powers instead of keeping the awarded powers to the bare minimum necessary to care for appellant's needs? And three, did the trial court abuse its discretion when it made findings from evidence not contained in the record or admissible under the rules of evidence, thereby prejudicing appellant? The facts briefly in this matter are: on March 17, 2019, appellant called 911 with concerns regarding her mother, who was intoxicated and making suicidal statements. Appellant resided with her mother in Stacy, Minnesota. On that date, appellant told the emergency services that arrived that she had not been to the hospital for approximately 10 to 15 years, that she had been ill, and that her vision had deteriorated in the last 2 weeks. EMS ended up bringing her to the hospital and diagnosing her with idiopathic intracranial hypertension, which is a pressure within her skull. She had actually gone blind due to this condition. It was also discovered at the hospital in March 2019 that appellant had not received any formal education after being taken out of school in the seventh grade.
Do you mind if I jump you from the facts to the legal argument? Does the record indicate or suggest the consequences or the risks involved in your client not taking the medication after the medical procedure, the stunts? Or stents that were placed?
Yes, Your Honor. If she were to not take her medication and have regular checkups, she could have potentially develop a blood clot. Her blood levels were being monitored after her hospitalization and in the hopes of avoiding a blood clot. So from the record, that is one potential complication.
And does the record suggest the consequences of a blood clot?
It does not, Your Honor.
Would you agree that the consequences are likely serious?
Yes, Your Honor.
So when you say that there is no evidence presented that she's unable to care for herself with regard to her medical needs, how do you respond to the fact that she was failing to take the medication after. Well, both, there's two stages. One was failing to respond to her limited or limiting vision as her vision deteriorated, resulting in her blindness. And two, after medical intervention at that point, her failure to keep current her prescription and keep taking her medications.
Yes, Your Honor, and it's my understanding from the record that she did not refill her medications because her mother did not provide her transportation to get those medications. And so I submit, and just jumping ahead briefly, I submit that there was a lesser restrictive alternative and or fewer powers that could have been awarded to ensure that the appellant
received. Right. Well, I understand that argument, but before you get to that, I think, if I understand your brief correctly, that's your alternative argument. Your primary argument is that there wasn't clear and convincing evidence to substantiate any guardianship. And so I just wanted to get a sense of how that's so in your mind, given the significance of the consequences of not maintaining her medications.
Well, Your Honor, I think the evidence that has to be presented at a clear and convincing level has to be quite substantial. It's more than a preponderance of the evidence, and I think it has to be shown with more than just that there could be a blood clot, a statement that there could be a blood clot. I think there's got to be some more medical evidence or some more explanation as to specifically why she did need a guardian and she was not, and the danger of that if she did not meet her medical needs.
I thought you recognized that the danger of not taking the anti-clotting medication could be life-threatening, and that on her own, without a guardian, she had allowed herself to fail to take the medication and fail to maintain a quantity of the medication after her prescription ran out. How is that not enough, I guess, is what I'm asking you, in light of the consequences?
I guess I submit, Your Honor, that there just should have been more. There should have been some medical testimony. There should have been a little bit more extensive testimony.
Why would that be necessary if you're acknowledging that that it's clear to you, and I think it's probably clear and just common knowledge of blood clotting and brain circumstances, that this is life-threatening? Why do you need more? What more would a medical professional say other than what you've acknowledged, which is that her condition is life-threatening if she failed to take her medication and she was failing to take her medication?
Well, I think also there the evidence could have been presented as far as any additional assistance that could have been provided. So if the evidence was clear and convincing that she needed a guardian at least on that issue, at least on the medical needs issue, which I acknowledge, Your Honor, is not the strongest part of my argument. I think the strongest part of my argument is considering fewer powers or lesser restrictive alternatives. I do acknowledge that. It just seems that in this type of case where someone's civil liberties are being restricted so dramatically, I think there needs to be a little bit more given than just here's what could happen. All right, let's move on. It just seems like there could have been more evidence that would have been presented to support the need for a guardian and a little bit more explanation of the medical condition and medical issues involved and potential dangers.
But counsel, what is the evidence in the record of any self-care by your client? I mean, there was, you know, no effort for her to seek alternative means to care for herself. She allowed her medical condition to deteriorate to very serious conditions. So what is the alternative to self-care that is in the record?
Well, and Your Honor, and that's a good question. A good way to, I guess, look at it would be what is the evidence that she was not self-caring outside of the medical needs? And I understand, obviously, that's very important and very serious, but I think it was up to the respondent to prove that she was not meeting her needs for self-care. I submit respectfully it was not my client's burden to show that she was meeting her needs for self-care.
And I completely agree with that. It's not your client's burden to establish that she's meeting her needs, but in the face of all of the evidence that she was not meeting her needs, is there something that would suggest to the district court that the evidence isn't clear and convincing that her medical needs are, in particular, are in need of significant, supervision and control?
Is there anything that would not indicate? No, I agree with that, Your Honor. No, there's nothing that would indicate she was effectively meeting her medical needs.
I don't want to arm wrestle you out of any position, but am I discerning correctly that you are essentially acknowledging that your real argument, the substantive argument, is that perhaps the guardianship order went too far, not that the evidence was not sufficient to establish that your client really needed a guardian to protect herself from the medical circumstances?
Short answer, yes, Your Honor. I'm not conceding that there was clear and convincing evidence for the appointment of a guardian overall. However, the main thrust of my argument, and I think the stronger argument, yes, is that the powers were too broad. There weren't lesser restrictive alternatives that were considered. Obviously, her medical needs are very important, serious, and should be given attention.
So I'm clear on your alternative argument, is your position simply that the guardianship should have been limited to the medical care issues, or is your argument that there were some other alternatives that were provided or for the district court to consider that the district court did not consider? If so, what were those other alternative lesser means?
Yes, Your Honor, I don't believe that there were any alternatives that were presented other than just a blanket request to deny the petition.
Who has the burden? If is it your client's burden to show that, you know, here are some other alternatives you should consider, Judge, or is it the burden on the government to show that this is necessary?
Your Honor, I would say both. I guess I think the burden is on the government to show that there's nothing else that can be done before it takes such a drastic step and request.
Were there other alternatives then offered to the district court by your client for the court to consider?
There were not, Your Honor, and I would acknowledge that the government did try I think they tried home services or county monitoring for a period of 2 to 3 months from March 2019 to May 2019. However, it's not up to the county to constantly, I don't believe, monitor my client. And so I don't know if that was a lesser restrictive alternative that opposing counsel is going to argue. But as far as my client, did she present any lesser restrictive alternatives? From a review of the record, no. I did not represent her.
So what exactly is your position now as to lesser alternatives? Is your position that the guardianship should be only limited to medical? Or are you saying that there's some other way to construct the guardianship other than the way it was designed?
Your Honor, I think the stronger argument and what I'm saying is that there should have been lesser powers awarded to the guardian. The powers that were awarded were overbroad and it should have been restricted. The guardianship should have been restricted to only the powers relating to medical care contained in parens 2 and 4.
So counsel, to that point, there was testimony by Strzok that there was not a less restrictive alternative available for your client, and the district court found that testimony by Strzok to be credible. And we generally defer to credibility determinations and don't review those on appeal. So why isn't that sufficient for us?
Well, Your Honor, and I think we need to look at, I'm not arguing that an award of fewer statutory powers is necessarily a lesser restrictive alternative. I think lesser restrictive alternatives could include perhaps home care services, could include some other in-home services, perhaps a county caseworker or arms worker. Those would be more lesser restrictive alternatives. I think a limited guardianship is more what I'm arguing as far as, both the lesser restrictive alternatives should have been continued, but also a limited guardianship with an award of only the powers contained in parens 2 and 4 in the powers statute, the guardianship statute. I don't think that's a credibility issue. I think as far as awarding fewer statutory powers. Again, I don't think that Mr. Strzok saying there are no lesser restrictive alternatives goes to that issue. I submit that the presumption is that the powers are going to be limited under the law. The powers that are awarded should be limited under the law, again, because we're restricting someone's civil liberties so much. And so the court should have started from that presumption instead of awarding all the powers. I'm not sure if that answered the court's question or not.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I do have a follow-up question. And just to be clear, it wasn't explicit in your brief, but it seemed to be a little bit of insinuation that in terms of alternative, at this time, you're not arguing that she remained living with her mother, do you?
That she should have? I think she could have. I think in this case, Solid Oak, a professional guardian, could have been appointed to allow her to remain in her home, but then that guardian still has the duty to arrange transportation for her regularly to and from medical facilities, to regularly visit her in her home, to ensure she has her medications, to ensure that they're lined up and ready for her to go and she understands how to take them.
So that's even though there's a finding of caregiver neglect by her mother?
Yes, Your Honor, I think the two still could have happened. The finding of caregiver neglect, I'm not sure what exactly that was based on, if that was based on the medical neglect as well as potential educational neglect, I don't know. But I think she could have remained in her home. She wanted to remain in her home. That's where she testified she wants to be, and I think she could have done so safely, again, with a limited guardian, and it still could have been the same guardian, but somebody just to ensure she's meeting her medical care needs.
Thank you, counsel. And you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you so choose. For appellant, you'll have 15 minutes, and you'll see on there should be a screen that has a clock there that you can see how much time you have remaining. So you may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Amy Capelli. I'm an assistant Chisago County attorney, and I represent the respondent in this matter. Today, the respondent asked the court to affirm the district court order appointing the guardian for appellant. Your Honors, in light of the court's questioning and the focus of opposing counsel's argument, what I'd like to say is that, as set forth in our brief, we believe that the facts in the record establish that the appellant was not able to meet her needs for medical care and for safety. But moving on from that to address the issue of less restrictive alternatives, there was testimony in the record, and Ms. Buberl alluded to this as well, that following appellant's first hospitalization, she was discharged to her mother's home with home care services in place. That's on page 10 of the transcript, Your Honor. Additionally, there was follow-up, including, of course, taking her medications, getting regular blood levels tested to make sure that she wasn't going to form a blood clot. This was discussed with appellant and her mother. And I should say that at this time, I don't think there's any dispute that appellant's mother was providing the cares for appellant. Appellant was not providing her own care. She relied on her mother. So this information about what appellant needed to do in order to be safe and to meet her medical needs was communicated to her by the hospital. It was communicated to her by Mr. Strzok. The county then provided transportation assistance to appellant and her mother so that she could attend these appointments. A referral was made to the state services of the blind, as appellant was now blind and needed to navigate that new environment. A referral was made for a MND choices assessment. There were referrals made for occupational therapy. And so for 2 months until May 24th of 2019, those services were being followed through by appellant and her mother with the assistance of the county. Then the county got to a point where it appeared that perhaps appellant and her mother would be able to navigate this on their own. So they closed their case. And that's when things started to again deteriorate. And at that point, again, the appellant had to call 911 in July of 2019. Due to her mother's own level of intense intoxication and suicidal statements. And even after...
When you say intense intoxication, I thought I read that something about what the PBT level was. And
I believe it was... I'm sorry, Your Honor.
No, go ahead. I think you're going to give me the number. It seemed, at least the number I saw, I don't wouldn't necessarily characterize as intense intoxication. What was the level that you saw?
It was a 0.30, Your Honor, and she was actually placed on a health and welfare hold and taken to the hospital by law enforcement. So she was severely intoxicated, not appellant's mother.
I thought I saw 0.03, but you're saying it was 0.3?
I think the appellant herself had a 0.03, but that honestly was not the issue. I mean, she's an adult. She can consume alcohol unless she's told not to by her physician. The issue was that her caregiver was at a 0.3, taken to the hospital, making suicidal statements, and appellant was left alone. And not only was she left alone, but after having a major surgery, after being diagnosed and becoming blind, she didn't recognize that the fact that she had been without her medications for 1 to 2 weeks, that she had been having headaches for 2 to 3 weeks, she didn't recognize that that was something where she needed medical care. And so the only reason she even got medical care is because the trailer park manager knew that her mother had been taken out of the home and she was having these issues.
It seems pretty clear to me, and I don't mean to speak for the court. I don't. I'm only telling you my impression, and it may not be a conclusive impression, but my impression is that there's plenty of evidence demonstrating her need for extraordinary care with regard to her medical issues. But as it regards her nutrition, her clothing, her shelter, and otherwise her safety, I'm concerned that the district court's granting a full authority for guardianship in all of these categories rather than focusing the guardianship on the very specific category of that was, I think, most clearly substantiated by the evidence, might have been overbroad. Can you address the appellant alternative argument that this could have been a much more limited guardianship and still taking care of all of the real concerns that were substantiated with the evidence?
Yes, Your Honor, thank you. First of all, I would say that aside from the medical care issue, one of the most important needs that the respondent has is a need for safety. And I don't believe, and I don't think the district court believed, that Ms. Bonaparte's need for safety was being met in the home where she was residing with her mother. And additionally, that she was unable to recognize any sort of inherent or obvious risk to her safety in that home.
Well, when her mother, you've identified the one incident where her mother was intoxicated, but she responded to that by contacting police and making sure emergency services were provided. I think that's the sort of thing that you would expect someone who had some capacity, maybe sufficient capacity, to do. So besides that incident, is there anything that the record offers to show that there was a significant safety concern beyond the medical issues?
Your Honor, I would first note that there were two similar incidents. And while the district court did acknowledge that the appellant called 911, she was not calling 911 for her own safety. She was calling 911 because her mother was making suicidal statements. So she wasn't recognizing the danger that she was in with her caregiver, who was, as I indicated, extremely intoxicated and suicidal. She wasn't recognizing that put her in a danger. And
why does that matter if she took the same steps to remediate the danger?
Because once her caregiver was taken out of the home, she had no ability to care for herself whatsoever. And so the only reason...
I guess that's what I'm looking for. What is there in the record to show that in those moments where her mother might be temporarily out of the home, she's incapable of providing for her own needs as it regards nutrition, clothing, and shelter?
I think there was no dispute, Your Honor, that, again, she relied completely on her mother for all of her cares, whether it be providing food, whether it be providing shelter. And so without her mother there to do those things... Oh, no. Can you hear me, Your Honor?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay, all of a sudden a screen popped up and it it scared me. Okay. So she was unable to do all those things on her own. I don't think there was any dispute.
When you say she was unable to do those things on her own, you mean shop for groceries, or what exactly is there that in the record that shows what was she lacking, I guess, is what I'm looking for.
Thank
and
you.
Again, and here I'm looking for clear and convincing evidence to show that perhaps, you know, this is a sufficiently broad.
Yes, Your Honor. And I know there is evidence of this in the record. I believe that Mr. Stroop testified that Ms. Broom or Bonaparte did not have the ability to provide her own housing. She did not have the ability to go seek out or pay for groceries. She did not have the ability to take care of her basic needs. She didn't know how to arrange appointments or get to them when she had them scheduled, other than relying on somebody else to do that for her.
When we say appointments, I mean, I would assume that if the appointments are concerning medical needs, that a guardianship that focuses on medical care would accommodate any transportation issues.
I believe so, Your Honor. But I would also submit that in terms of limiting the guardianship, I think there was testimony in the record that, as I've already addressed, that I believe that her home was unsafe and she wanted to return to her mother's home in a place where, again, the county would submit that she was unsafe. Where her caregiver had a neglect or a maltreatment determination substantiated against her. But additionally, Your Honor, that she didn't understand the process for getting a legal form of identification. She didn't understand the process for opening a bank account. She wasn't able to seek a name change on her own, which was the linchpin of getting the identification and the bank account. And so she wouldn't be able to contract if she decided to do so with anyone. She wouldn't be able to enter into or to apply for benefits that would be entitled to her on her own, medical assistance, waivered services, unemployment, disability.
When you say she wouldn't be able to contract, you mean she lacked the capacity to enter a contract?
Yeah, correct. And Your Honor, I would also note that regarding the supervisory powers, it's the county's position that the court found that she was unable to understand the unsafe situation that she was in when she resided with her mother, and then the desire to then return to her mother necessitated the need for a guardian to supervise to make sure that she's safe, not to restrict her civil liberties to an extreme extent.
Can you expound on how she was unsafe? What were the risks that she faced with her mother that were sort of substantiated with evidence?
Well, again, the intoxication, her mother's inability to recognize Miss Broom's need for medical care. There was evidence in the record that she had.
Well, but I'm assuming that she had a guardian to address her medical care, so she's not relying on her mother for those things. I'm looking for evidence, not to show general incapacitation, but concerns about nutrition, clothing, and shelter.
Yeah, I can say I don't have any concerns about Ms. Broom's mother's ability to provide nutrition for Ms. Broom, because I don't believe there's any evidence of that in the record. And likewise, the clothing piece is not an issue.
And shelter, there is no dispute that she had a place to stay, that her mother provided her residence.
She had a place to stay, Your Honor, but again, I would submit that it was an unsafe place for her to be, and that...
Well, that's what I'm trying to get at. In what way was it unsafe? As far as the evidence goes in the record, what's the basis for a district court determining that a guardian is necessary to protect her safety if the medical concerns are taken care of?
Well, the extreme level of her mother's intoxication on more than one occasion, the need to call for 911, suicidal statements by her caregiver.
When you say more than one occasion, was it two occasions?
Two that are in the record, Your Honor, yes.
So two is all we have.
That's correct.
All right.
And I think all of that coupled with the fact that she's now blind creates an expanded need for safety, where if she had been with her mother after the first hospitalization and had been in a position where she had been able to navigate the surroundings, had followed up with the occupational therapy services, had followed up with state services for the blind, perhaps I wouldn't be here saying that her mother is an unsafe place. But because that didn't happen, and because Ms. Bonaparte found herself back in the hospital, unable to care for herself. That's why the county petitioned for guardianship. And again, Your Honor, we believe that the county, or that the court did not abuse its discretion by appointing the guardian all of the powers that are enumerated in Minnesota statute. And unless there are any further questions, I would yield the remainder of my time.
Judge Ross, Judge Frisch, any further questions?
None for me.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for respondent, or I'm sorry, counsel for appellant, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Yes, Your Honor, thank you. So I think the court has narrowed itself somewhat to, I think, the main and the strongest argument in this case. Minnesota law provides twice in the statutory scheme that the powers have to be limited. A trial court is required to, it's not may, a trial court shall grant to a guardian only those powers necessitated by the ward's limitations and demonstrated needs. For needs that were demonstrated in this case were needs that required, that may have required the appointment of a guardian, were medical needs.
Counsel, that's not entirely fair. I mean, when I look at the district court's order, there are findings regarding concerns for your client's cognitive abilities and her IQ. There are issues regarding housing. There are issues regarding lack of identification, inability to open a bank account, and inability to arrange for any transportation for any purposes, which would include just everyday needs. So there are findings in the district court's order that go well beyond the scope of the medical issues, which are significant. Wouldn't you agree with that?
I would agree with that. I would agree, yes, that perhaps she was unable to do those things. However, simply because somebody may not have received formal schooling and because somebody may not know how to open up a bank account on their own, if their needs for housing, nutrition, and just their general safety needs are being met, that doesn't mean that we appoint a guardian for somebody because they might not be doing as well as they possibly could. She was moved out of her mother's home and moved into a group home. And is she accessing services now? Likely, yes. And she is learning Braille and taking educational classes and doing things that, according to the record, she hasn't done since the seventh grade. That's great, but that's not what she wants. So she wants to be back in her mother's care. And as long as her mother has a house, her mother provided her food, those needs were being met. If my client's mother moves out or passes away or is somehow removed from the home, well, then we have a different story.
Well, can you address the issue of mother's intoxication and discuss that concern as it applies to safety?
Sure, Your Honor. So if appellant's mother was her primary caregiver in the home and she was consuming alcohol to the point of being so intoxicated that appellant felt the need to call 911, well, that's concerning. But that, again, there was no evidence presented in the record as to how appellant's mother's intoxication affected my client's or appellant's safety needs. There's no nexus or connection between the intoxication. And the appellant did what she needed to do to meet her needs for safety. And whether she called 911 for her mother or for herself, who really cares? She still knew to dial 911 when she felt that she needed help. So I don't think there's any connection between the mother's intoxication and the need for a guardian.
Well, but doesn't it, I think it does matter whether she's calling 911 for, in order to assist her mother. It's showing that she's not meeting her own needs. She never called a doctor or never called 911 or called anybody else for assistance to address her own conditions. And I think that is significant because that does tie to her personal care, her personal needs, her medical needs, her safety needs.
Sure, Your Honor. Yes, and that, and again, I go back to a limited guardian who's ensuring that her medical care needs and needs for safety are being met could address that issue, could check in regularly, can ensure she's taking her medications. So the fact that appellant called call 911 for her mother rather than for herself? Well, yeah, yes, it's somewhat concerning, but again, that doesn't mean that we just appoint a guardian with all the powers and remove appellant from her home and put her into a foster home. There has to be a different option than a full-blown guardianship in this case, because the result to appellant was extreme. She was removed from the care of her mother. She was moved to a different home, to a group home. And while she might be taking classes and doing well now, that's not what she wants. And so I just simply submit that the power should have been limited and ask the court to remand with an order requiring limited guardianship. Thank you.
Thank you both. It was very well briefed and very well argued. We appreciate that. We will be issuing an order in this case within the 90-day statutory time frame. Thank you both. Stay safe and stay well.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors. I appreciate it. Have a good day.
Thank you, you too.
Thank you.